Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on August 9, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on overcriminalization. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups of the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And unlike most of our teleforum calls, this call is open to press, so I want to welcome those members of the press who have dialed in. Today, we welcome two experts to lead our discussion on overcriminalization. We'll begin with opening remarks of about 10 to 12 minutes from each of them, first from George Terwilliger, followed by Dr. Whit Ayers, then some discussion, and then your questions. George Terwilliger is a senior partner at White & Case and heads its global white-collar practice group. There, he provides counsel in litigation, internal investigations, and enforcement proceedings, especially those involving the U.S. Department of Justice, Securities and Exchange Commission, and other primary enforcement agencies. In public service, Mr. Terwilliger served as a United States Attorney and as Deputy Attorney General, the number two official in the Department of Justice, and as Acting Attorney General. Dr. Whit Ayers is the president of North Star Opinion Research, formerly Ayers, McHenry, and Associates. Prior to establishing the firm, Dr. Ayers served as senior executive assistant for budget and policy to Governor Carol Campbell in South Carolina. He's also the chairman of the American Association of Political Consultants, a bipartisan national organization that promotes the political consulting industry, protects political freedom of speech, and fosters ethical behavior in political campaigns. With that, Mr. Terwilliger, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean. And good afternoon to everyone joining us on the call. It's a pleasure to be with the Federalist Society on this call with Dr. Ayers and with all of you. I thought it might be useful at the outset to just briefly perhaps define and put in context what we're talking about when we use the buzz term overcriminalization. A steady stream of commerce, economic growth, and commercial vitality, as we all know, do not occur on their own. The government has a role in the promotion of commerce and in our economic vitality, and its principal role at the federal level is to protect the means and instrumentalities of that commerce and protect it in a way that fosters economic vitality. Overregulation in general and the criminalization of government regulation, however, have the potential, and in fact, in my view, have inhibited commerce rather than promoted and protected it. The result of overcriminalization is the abandonment of traditional notions underlying our understandings in Anglo-American law of what is a crime, including most notably the necessity to show that a defendant has acted intentionally and has had an intent, in fact, to do a bad thing which the law forbids. If I am correct that the appropriate use of criminal law on the federal level is to protect the means and instrumentalities of commerce, that means protecting us from fraud on or in the markets. A market distorted by fraud and corruption, of course, cannot be a free market. Maintaining an honest and free marketplace is, in fact, essential to our economy, and criminal law, including the investigation and prosecution of fraud in the marketplace, is a traditional, powerful, and, in my view, appropriate tool for protecting the means and instrumentalities that are necessary to our sound economic health. Raising concerns about overcriminalization does not mean favoring leniency for fraudsters, hucksters, liars, cheats, or others. Rather, overcriminalization is the process whereby criminal laws of general application are applied to what is otherwise legitimate activity, but activity that is regulated in its nature, extent, and reporting by the federal government. So why is overcriminalization a bad thing? What does it do? The shift from protecting the means and instrumentalities of commerce from external forces which distort and destroy them, that to a circumstance where criminal law is overused as a regulatory tool may do more to threaten than protect the economy because it chills, among other things, the entrepreneurial risk-taking that is essential to economic growth. Attaching criminal sanctions to violations of highly technical or vague or unintelligible regulatory standards is also offensive to well-established notions of due process of law and may in fact engender lack of respect for the rule of law. Let me just take a moment to try to put in concrete terms what we mean by overcriminalization, and I'll do it in two contexts, if I may. One, cases involving individuals, and two, cases involving institutions or corporations. Many of you who have an interest in this subject may have noted that just within the past several days, the company Gibson Guitars pled guilty to a violations of certain federal statutes. Gibson was originally raided at its Nashville factory under suspicion of violating the Lacey Act for importing exotic wood inventory for use in manufacturing its guitars, where the wood allegedly was taken in violation of both foreign laws and imported into the United States. A similar case some time ago, about 10 years ago, involved a lobster importer who was indicted on 47 counts of conspiracy, smuggling, money laundering, and Lacey Act violations, again, for importing lobster that did not comply with Honduran export requirements. So it wasn't that it was some U.S. law that was violated. The violation was bringing into the United States lobster that 2.5% of a 70,000-pound shipment were smaller than the requisite 5.5 inches. Some of the lobster tails had not been processed according to specifications of Honduran law, and they were shipped in plastic bags rather than individual boxes. More recently, you may have read of the case where a commercial whale watcher in Monterey Bay, California, had an incident occur where one of her employees reported another of her employees for whistling at a whale, which, according to the whistleblower, according to the complainant, constituted harassment of a marine mammal. The federal authorities requested a videotape that they had reason to believe that existed, and the owner of the company submitted it and edited the tape to, in fact, highlight the whistling incident. The federal authorities determined that that whistling did not constitute harassment, but nonetheless indicted the owner of the company for making materially false statements to the government by editing the tape. There are a number of other examples like this. You may have heard from some, and perhaps in the discussion we can get to some. But what problem does this create? First, it is the abandonment of the principles of fundamental fairness, which are supposed to animate and really define what we mean by the rule of law. It also induces a fading moral force, in my view, and moral legitimacy of the criminal code as mens rea requirements, the traditional notion of doing something bad that the law forbids, are softened or abandoned. And third, it produces an unhealthy reliance on prosecutorial and law enforcement discretion due to an ever-expanding federal criminal code and regulations, whereby prosecutors may, and in fact do, become super regulators allowed to impose their view as to what is an appropriate federal regulatory standard over and above what may be in the regulations or even intended by the regulators themselves. What can we do about this situation? I think there's a number of things. First, Congress needs to arrest its knee-jerk reaction to every new scandal that comes along, whether it's passing FIREA as a result of the savings and loan crisis, to Sarbanes-Oxley as a result of the financial reporting so-called crisis, and so forth. We've all seen instances where Congress closes the door after the horse is out of the barn with new laws that are designed to even further regulate and restrict commercial activity through the use of criminal sanctions. Stopping that trend would be a big step in the right direction. Consolidating the current federal criminal code into one code, which it's designed to be that way in Title 18, would also be a step forward for perhaps the first time we could actually see how much actually is against the federal criminal law. Third, we could place much greater emphasis on requiring knowing and intentional conduct before imposing criminal liability and in fact reduce the number of strict liability offenses. And lastly, to cover some of these outlier cases where I have a great deal of respect for the judgment and integrity of federal prosecutors around the country. Day in and day out, they make sound, good decisions. But there will always be some outliers, and formalizing a method by which appeal can be had within the Justice Department without risk of retaliation as a practical matter would go a long way to making sure these cases got the kind of high-level attention they deserve. With that, I will turn it over to Dr. Ayers to pick up the discussion.
George, thank you very much, and thank all of you for joining us today to talk about a fascinating subject of overcriminalization. Back in March, my firm, North Star Opinion Research, which is primarily supports Republican candidates, teamed with the Melman Group, Mark Melman, the well-known Democratic pollster that primarily supports Democratic candidates, to do a bipartisan survey of registered voters nationally regarding criminal justice reform and overcriminalization. It's a standard national survey, 1,000 registered voters, all 50 states plus D.C., selected through random digit dialing, including cell phones. And we discovered a number of things. It was something of a challenge to write the questionnaire. We couldn't use phrases like mens rea, and trying to translate some of the legal concepts into dime store English we found challenging, but I think we ultimately ended up with a very defensible questionnaire. First of all, it's very clear that voters generally draw clear distinctions when it comes to defining offenses as criminal or civil. We asked a number of examples and asked people if they thought each of the following types of offenses should be covered by criminal law, which could be punishable by prison time, or civil law, which could be punishable by other methods such as probation or fines. At the top of the list was defrauding people of their retirement savings, where 85% thought that should be covered by criminal law, followed closely by manslaughter or unintentionally killing another person with 81%. Then we started getting somewhat lower percentages, but still a majority believing these should be covered by criminal law, importing prescription drugs from foreign countries, or major pollution of the environment, like an oil spill. Then we get into very even divisions, similar to the case that George talked about. Importing natural materials from a foreign country, like wood or seafood, in violation of that country's laws. 49% thought that should be covered by criminal law, 47% by civil law. And now we have three examples where overwhelming majorities thought the violation should be covered by civil, not criminal law. Minor pollution of the environment, like disposing of garbage on public lands or waters, downloading copyrighted music or movies from the internet, and failing to obtain required permits for an action, but not causing harm to person or property. In that last example, 82% thought that should be covered by civil law, only 13% by criminal law. So there's a clear distinction here on how people view various violations. Voters did not believe a business owner or CEO should go to prison for the criminal actions of an employee. We asked it two different ways, depending on the size of the business. If an employee of a small or medium-sized business committed committed criminal actions without the knowledge of the owner of the business, do you think the owner should or should not go to prison? 78% thought they should not go to prison. Only 16% said they should. The margin's closer for large corporations. If an employee of a large corporation committed actions without the knowledge of the chief executive officer of the corporation, do you think the chief executive officer should or should not go to prison? But even in that case, a significant majority, 56%, thought they should not go to prison. 39% thought they should. Nor do they think the CEO of a drug company should go to prison for unknowingly selling a harmful drug. Say a drug company developed a drug they did not think was harmful, and the Food and Drug Administration approved the drug for sale to the public. If the drug later turned out to be harmful, do you think the chief executive officer of the drug company should or should not go to prison? A strong majority, 61%, believe the CEO should not go to prison. Only 32% thought he should. We then tried to distinguish between two different types of criminal acts. And here's the language we used. Our criminal justice system punishes two types of criminal acts. The first are acts that are inherently wrong, that the average person knows to be against the law, such as murder, robbery, and fraud. The second are acts that are not inherently wrong, but that the government has declared to be against the law, such as failure to submit required paperwork, filling out government forms incorrectly, or violating government regulations. Think for a moment about the second type of criminal acts, those not inherently wrong. Which of the following comes closer to your view? One, a person who commits this type of crime should only go to prison if prosecutors can prove that the person knew that their action was illegal or they intended to commit a crime. Or two, a person who commits this type of crime should go to prison if prosecutors can prove that the person violated the regulation regardless of their knowledge of the law or intent to commit a crime. In other words, the guilty mind requirement. A strong majority, 57%, thought that the person who commits this type of crime should only go to prison if they can prove that the person knew their action was illegal or they intended to commit a crime. 37% thought they should go to prison if the prosecutors can prove that they violated the regulation regardless of their knowledge or intent to commit a crime. So 57-37 people believe they should not go to prison if they did not know it was a violation. A strong majority also believes that so many laws are so complex that the average person cannot know what is illegal. Which of the following statements comes closer to your view? One, because there are so many vague and complex laws, the average person cannot know all the acts that are illegal. People should not go to prison for doing things that the average person would not know are illegal. Or two, because ignorance of the law is no excuse. If someone unknowingly breaks the law, they should be punished, regardless of the type of law or if that punishment includes prison time. The phrase, because ignorance of the law is no excuse, is so much a part of our culture, we expected that argument to be very powerful. But in fact, 60% of respondents did not agree with that argument. 60% said the average person cannot know that all acts that are illegal and people should not go to prison for doing things the average person would not know are illegal. 60% chose that option. 34% chose the option that said, because ignorance of the law is no excuse, they should go to prison anyway. Finally, we asked support and opposition for a number of reforms to deal with overcriminalization. The one that got the strongest, most intense support is stop Congress from passing vague and unclear criminal laws that open the door to unfair and random enforcement by the government. 70% overall supported that, but 45% strongly supported stopping Congress from passing vague and unclear criminal laws. Other reforms that got significant support or stop Congress from making criminal laws in areas that are better left to state governments. 76% overall support, 38 strongly. Stop giving prison sentences to people who violate regulations and instead use fines where necessary. 74% overall, 35% strongly. And stop giving prison sentences to people who commit offenses that do not cause harm to people or property. 71% overall, 33% strongly. So clearly there is support in public opinion for a number of reforms that would address many of the cases that George discussed. I look forward to your questions and the discussion. Dean, let me pass it back to you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ayers. Before we get to the audience questions, I want to give George Terwilliger a minute or two to react to what you've just said. George?
Thank you, Dean. It's a very interesting and fascinating research, and I think that what it shows to me more than anything else is that wonderful common sense of the American people about what is in fact fair and what is not. It also, I think, speaks to the people's sense of the appropriate roles of different levels of government. I was particularly struck by the support for the idea that some things ought to be regulated and controlled by states rather than by the federal establishment. I think that more research and analysis of this sort could play a vital role in convincing members of Congress to try to put back within its proper confines the role of the federal establishment and the role of federal law enforcement, which, I want to repeat, has a very important role in general, but also a vital role in economic affairs by protecting the means and instrumentalities of commerce. Unfortunately, for a variety of reasons, we have strayed far from that purpose, and it's long past time to begin a corrective process.
Very good. Let's turn now to the audience. And before we do that, I want to remind folks that unlike most of our teleforum calls, we have invited the press to this call. So I suppose in that sense, we're on the record today. In a moment, you'll hear an announcement that the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for either or even both of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Hold on momentarily. Looks like we have two questions to start us off, and then our phone lines are open.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. What I haven't heard in the discussion is an examination of the very sharp constitutional boundaries between federal and state penal powers, and whether those were, whether the public opinion was examined with an awareness of that in mind. I suspect that if you had brought out that distinction more clearly, that you would have gotten much more meaningful results. But of course, public opinion doesn't determine what is constitutional. And I think we're going to need to confront the fact that 95% or more of all federal criminal statutes are unconstitutional, according to the Constitution, as originally meant and understood, and that we need to overturn the court precedents going all the way back to McCulloch v. Maryland in order to correct this apostasy.
Who wants to react to that?
It's a bold proposition. I'm not sure that I could agree with it in all respects, because the federal government under the Constitution does have a role, but I don't really think that's what this debate is about. I think it's within the parameters that the Supreme Court has established as the appropriate federal role, what is both as a matter of the exercise of prosecutorial discretion as well as the exercise of prudent political judgment, what is the proper role of the federal government and the proper use of criminal statutes. I appreciate the point that as a general proposition, the size, scope, and role of the federal establishment in the lives of individual Americans has grown well beyond anything that the founders may have envisioned. But I'm not sure I'd go quite as far as the caller suggested in what that means.
Dr. Ayers, did you care to weigh in here?
I think I'll let the attorney give the answer to that one.
Very good. Let's go to the next question.
Hi, I live in a county in Washington State with a zoning code that has not only large fines, but recently it was expanded to include up to a year in jail for a zoning violation, if you can imagine. Jail time for a zoning violation seems like criminalization to me by definition. And this extends, zoning includes a home occupation ordinance, regulation that says that you could commit a zoning infraction by practicing a certain trade, even a legal trade, in the wrong zoning area. I'm wondering if that would, you know, jail time for a zoning infraction would be cruel and unjust under the Constitution. We're just not sure in this area what sort of a defense a violator might have in that case.
Right. Well, you know, I can't sort of comment on a very knowledgeably on a hypothetical case, but. As a general proposition, I think the example you give of a zoning violation leading to jail time would certainly, as a general proposition, represent an inappropriate use of the criminal law. Zoning regulations and municipal ordinances of that sort are meant to regulate how things can be built and where they can be built, of course. And would not seem, I think, to the understanding of most people, to rise to the level of transgressions constituting criminal activity. But much the same thing occurs on the federal level. You know, nobody is for dirty air or dirty water. So we accept generally the notion that there is some federal role in promoting air and water quality and protecting air and water quality within certain standards. And certainly there are some environmental violations that would seem criminal in nature. Dumping a toxic substance, for example, into a water supply of a town or a county would certainly constitute the kind of intentional conduct that one would think that most people would find criminal in nature. But generally polluting, that is releasing toxic substances into the air or water, or maybe not toxic, maybe just undesirable substances, is something that not only is allowed, the government gives people permits to do it, called discharge permits by the EPA. What happens, though, is that exceeding those discharge permits that are measured usually in parts per million by even a little bit can become a felony. And thus, the stuff that experts can reasonably disagree about becomes the foundation for federal criminal investigations and prosecutions. That seems to me to be a similar kind of overreaching.
This is Whit Ayers. The example you give pretty well defines the end of the continuum where overwhelming majorities of American voters believe civil and not criminal law should apply. As I mentioned earlier, failing to obtain required permits for an action, but not causing harm to a person or property. 82% of registered voters nationally believe that should not be covered by criminal law, which could be punishable by prison time.
And that's precisely the sort of thing that happens here. Failure to apply for a permit is a crime. Not doing harm, no nexus, no nothing. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone while we wait to see if there are any more questions from our audience. Let me ask Dr. Ayers or even George Terwilliger, were there any big surprises you found in the survey data?
The primary surprise that I found was that once we said, because ignorance of the law is no excuse, I felt, and a lot of others who helped draft this questionnaire, felt that that would likely carry the day. And only one out of three American voters found that that was the case, and they simply believe that the guilty mind requirement is a reasonable and fair requirement if you're going to send someone to prison.
There's an analog to that, too, Dean. This is George Terwilliger, that might be worth mentioning here. While that well-known maxim, of course, carries a certain amount of legal validity, the survey response, in which two-thirds of the people sort basically rejected, as I understand what Dr. Ayers has told us, actually accurately reflects a very, very important legal principle that the Supreme Court has made clear many times over in cases where the clarity of the law or of a regulation upon which a criminal prosecution is based is less than desirable. The court has said, and I promise this will be the only court case quote I give in this call, but the court has said a penal statute must define a criminal offense with sufficient definiteness that ordinary people can understand what conduct is prohibited, and it must define it in a manner that does not encourage arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. I believe that the court, in establishing and maintaining and reinforcing that principle over the years, is simply reflecting the common sense notion of fairness that causes two-thirds of the survey respondents to say, no, ignorance of the law is no excuse, is not sort of the be-all and end-all of the analysis of these kinds of circumstances.
This is Dean Reuter again. I suppose it doesn't surprise me that the public seems to get the unfairness of it all. And Dr. Ayers, you mentioned, a mass of people who would be interested in reform efforts. Can either one of you talk about what reform efforts might look like? Is there a constituency for reform out there? How would this proceed?
I think people first need to be educated about these cases because a great many people are simply unaware of the kinds of injustices that occur in the name of enforcing the law. But once they're aware of them, they clearly support, overwhelmingly support, many of these reforms we discussed. George, you probably have additional comments on that one.
Well, thank you. I think there is a constituency for reform. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist in the U.S. Congress. It exists out in the public and in the voting public, as shown by these survey results. And I think it's really a further indication of a much larger phenomena at work in the body politic today, and that is that an increasingly large number of people, perhaps a majority, have sort of had it with how out of touch the federal establishment is with the effects of government in their daily lives and are looking to change things. I think Witt is absolutely right that if the public became steeped in the knowledge of the breadth and depth of overreaching by the federal government in the enforcement of law, again, not taking anything away from the good work that federal prosecutors and enforcement officials do day in and day out. But if the public became aware of not just these outlier cases, but some of the systemic matters that the federal government is involved in, there would be a broad level of support for reform that I think could begin by fundamentally asking as to every federal criminal law that's out there, is this a proper role of the federal government? Do we need this law? Is it actually accomplishing its intended purposes? Is it being enforced fairly and evenly across the nation? And if the answer to some of all of those questions may be no, then maybe that law needs to be taken off the books. And I think that could be done in a systemic and reasoned way.
This is Whit Ayers again. As part of this research, we did a number of focus groups with regular voters and went through some of the examples that George mentioned earlier, like the imported lobster tails from Honduras. Once people saw examples of this, they were stunned, absolutely stunned and outraged. And their reaction was, we need a little common sense brought to bear here. So there's no question that if they get knowledge of some of these cases, like the Gibson guitar case, they really get angry. They just aren't familiar with them for the most part right now.
Conversely, Dr. Ayers, I wonder if when it comes to discrete, a phenomenon I've often seen is something goes wrong in the American public and the federal government then passes a law, whether it's Enron or AIG or the Wisconsin shooting or the Aurora, Colorado shooting. Did the survey reveal anything about public sentiment for discrete criminal laws passed in the wake of some kind of scandal or catastrophe or tragedy, as opposed to the breadth of federal law, federal criminal law?
Yeah, the best that the survey can offer in response to that question is the reform that said Congress should stop passing vague and unclear criminal laws that opened the door to unfair and random enforcement by the government. That was overwhelmingly supported as a reform.
One comment on that. One of the things that happens fairly typically with some kind of a federal regulatory scheme as passed by Congress is that, in fact, the legislature itself is not defining the crimes, but rather the legislature is empowering in the law, in the statute, agencies to write regulations to effectuate the statute's purpose, and then makes certain categories or types of transgressions of those regulations a general crime under that statute. So thus, the legislature is not even defining what the crime is. The definition of crime falls instead to regulators. And that certainly seems to me to raise some very problematic public policy, if not constitutional issues.
Yeah, I can see that clearly. I guess my point was that the same public that seems sympathetic to the over-federalization of crime often seems to be the public that's calling for the federal government to do something in the wake of a discrete problem.
The politicians view the reason they act exactly that way, because the public wants them to do something. I think, though, what the survey results show is that what the public really wants, particularly once the heat of passion engendered by one of these types of occurrences passes, is the public wants a Congress that acts responsibly and reasonably and within the bounds of the Constitution as it defines the role of the federal government.
So maybe Congress seeing these survey results would be a helpful step. Looks like we do have a couple more questions from the audience. Let's go to that next question.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. Did your survey attempt to differentiate between different segments of the public? Because there is a growing awareness, mainly driven by the Internet, of these problems and of the need for reform. Not all the voting public is yet aware of this information on the Internet, but as they become more engaged with it, they are beginning to acquire it. And I think you'd find that there is a very rapid rise in awareness and concern about these problems, and that the people who demand Congress take action on something are generally not the people who are skeptical about it. They're generally two different groups of people.
I think it's a very good point about the importance of the Internet. That's how a great many people found out about Gibson Guitar. It certainly helps to have other news outlets covering those cases. And that then drives others to the internet to find out more about them and to get more educated. But your point is well taken. The more people find out about this, the more likely you are to generate support for meaningful reforms.
However, the kind of people that I talk to most, such as Tea Party groups, are very much engaged in demands for reform in this area. And they may still only be a minority of the population, but they are winning elections. So you may be able to see a lot more demand in the future on this. And what is most important, they are basing much of their demands for reform on drawing a distinction between what is and is not constitutional for each level of government.
And yes, sir.
Any future survey needs to examine awareness of that.
Yes, sir.
Okay, let's go to the next question.
Yes, I was wondering if Dr. Ayers would potentially venture to comment on how potent he believes a reform as a platform would be for a candidate compared to other political issues.
Well, it's a discrete subject, obviously. Nothing is going to replace jobs, economy, spending, and debt in this election. But there's always room for a candidate to make a passionate issue their own and thereby distinguish themselves from other candidates in a race. They would have to use as their hook some of the more egregious specific examples, some of which George talked about earlier, as a way to make people aware of some of the things this government is doing. And as I mentioned from the focus groups, once they are aware of it, they are appalled. So, yes, there would be an opportunity for a candidate to make over-criminalization or reform in this area a distinguishing issue, provided they relied on the specific examples to get people's attention and make them aware that there's a serious problem here.
Thank you.
Looks like we've got a couple more questions lined up. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to the next caller.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Gerard Lehman from the Boston chapter. Dr. Ayers, I'm wondering if your survey revealed anything about the respondents' views on how the government uses the criminal fines or disgorgements it collects. I know when I teach my FCPA classes at area colleges, one of the first questions I get is, well, what does the government do with the money? And I think I'm not so sure I have the best answer, and I'll leave it to Mr. Terwilliger to maybe fill the audience in on that. But is there anything from that point of view that colored people's response? Thanks.
We did not ask that question, but it's certainly an interesting one to put on a future survey.
All right. Looks like we've got one more question, and then our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone if you have a question.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. This is Bill Cyrus from Scope, New York. Got a question as to how this issue reaches into the problems that we have stemming from U.S. v. Caroline products and also Gonzales v. Raich as to the presumption of constitutionality of laws versus a general presumption of liberty as to what expectation an average citizen can have to be able to live their life without even running into a law at all.
Well, if you're asking it as a philosophical question, I think it's an excellent nexus to draw. We have, I think, as a general proposition, lost sight of the fact that the fundamental animating purpose of the federal government, even of the Constitution, rather, even as it enumerates and spells out the powers of the branches of the federal government, the real purpose of the Constitution is as a guarantee of individual liberty. And yet, in our legal analysis of many things, including, you know, what again is a general principle of recognize of the presumption of the validity of laws, most recently perhaps at work in the healthcare decision, we do not hear or see very often the notion of individual liberty as a constitutional principle come to the fore. And I think that's unfortunate. And I think to the extent your point is that it needs to be there, I think it's a point extremely well taken.
I mean, at what point do we have any Fifth Amendment or any Eighth Amendment at all if we're just to be constantly besieged by this stuff? I mean, the average citizen simply can't be parking $10,000 around for spare legal fees on the expectation, you know, that they'll violate something. I mean, when does any pushback against that trend begin at all?
Well, I think it's really, I would say, frankly, that it is primarily the duty of first litigants, then commentators, then office holders, then the courts, who, of course, can only deal or should only be dealing with that which is presented to them by the parties to a particular dispute. But I do think in some order, like I mentioned, there is a responsibility to bring the notion of individual liberty into this dialogue and debate. I think your point is well taken. Dean, I actually, if we have a moment, I'd like to just expand a bit on the last caller's question and point.
Go right ahead, and then I'm going to give you each an opportunity to wrap up. Before you do that, though, George, if I could just announce our next scheduled teleform call, at least next scheduled at this point in time, is next Thursday, August 16th, where we'll be giving an update on gun rights litigation that's taking place in the lower courts in the wake of the Heller and McDonald cases. That's next Thursday, August 16th. You can check our website for further details on that and other upcoming calls. But go right ahead, George Terwilliger.
Thank you. I think an underreported force at work among the public in the United States today, and particularly an under-referenced notion in the current political discourse, including on the presidential level, is the recognition of individual liberty as the fundamental purpose of our governing document, the Constitution, and of the federal establishment itself. And I think the caller really honed in on what is a very important point here that subsumes much of the rest of this debate, really, because what is at stake most fundamentally in all of this is the relationship between the government and individuals. Our country was founded on the notion that the least government, the better, the more individual freedom, the better. And we just do not see enough discussion of that in a variety of contexts, including the political one, in my humble opinion.
Dr. Ayers, it sounds like a lot of that showed up in your survey. Do you have any final thoughts before we adjourn the call?
Just a couple. Results will be made available by the Federalist Society after this call. So if you would like to get the results of this survey, they should be readily available from the Federalist Society. There are serious injustices occurring in this country under the guise of the rule of law. Unfortunately, not that many people know about them, although, as the one caller suggested, through the internet, the knowledge is spreading. But there are reforms that need to occur, because when you talk about specific examples with voters, they are appalled that something like this could occur in this country. So I encourage all of you to follow this issue, to get involved in this issue, and to support reforms that would stop some of the blatant injustices that are occurring in the current criminal justice system.
George Terwilliger, I don't know if you felt that that was your moment to wrap up, but let me come back to you one more time and see if you have any final thoughts.
Well, thank you, Dean. I'll wrap up perhaps a little bit on a more mundane point. People are not powerless to correct the trend of the federal government moving to the over-criminalization. And I think it's imperative that people act and be heard on this issue. I think the research that the Society commissioned and that Dr. Ayers so expertly, along with his colleague, undertook is an important step in that direction. But I also think this is about more than the question of just individual liberty. the more and the government reaches into the commercial world and into the workings of businesses, the more it drains resources from what those businesses are supposed to be about, and that is making things, delivering services, and so forth. And the more that happens, the less opportunity there is for those businesses to grow, the economy to flourish, and people to be working and supporting their families. So in a very real way, this is a very contemporary issue that has a very real effect on how our economy functions and on the very welfare of individual Americans. I thank the Society for the opportunity to comment on these matters today.
Well, let me thank both George Terwilliger and Whit Ayers for their thoughtful remarks today. I also, of course, want to thank, as always, the audience for joining us. Please do join us for our call next Thursday on an update on gun rights litigation. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.